Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Well, hello. I'm Susanna Constantine, and this is my wardrobe malfunction. Can you believe it? This is episode number 75. If you haven't joined us before, then you've got so much to catch up on. If you have, then hopefully you'll know by now that you're in good company. Thank you all for joining us. Right, on to today's special guest. I've admired her for years, but have been lucky enough to get to know her recently and now love her more than ever. It's the legendary model, muse and photographer, Patty Boyd. So let's grab the handles, open my wardrobe doors and find out what's inside. Today, I'm with someone who I can safely say is one of the most celebrated fashion icons, not just of her generation in the 60s, but of all the generations that followed. It's model, photographer, best-selling author and podcaster, Patty Boyd. At last, Patty, we're here and we're doing it. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Susanna. I'm sorry I've been here, there and everywhere. But, you know, you are so sweet and haven't let go and still want me on your podcast. And here I am.
Are you crazy? Because you've literally just got back from Tokyo, haven't you? From Japan.
Yes. Night before last.
Oh, my God. How are you dealing with all this travelling?
I don't know. I think the thing is to think about where you are today and not project into next week. Otherwise, it all becomes terribly confusing.
So true.
And more exhausting, actually.
And how's your wonderful book of iconic photographs been? How's it been going? Because everyone wants a bit of you, don't they?
It's been going so well, and it was rather sweet in Japan. I signed 300 books in 2 days, and I suggested that the Japanese, because I don't speak Japanese, that they write their name on a little post-it note, and then they'd go into files, and then come in one at a time, and I'd say, hello, Namiki, for example, and then they'd look at me in surprise that I know their name. Of course I do, have it on a piece of paper, and then sign a book for them. And they were thrilled. It was really adorable to see just how happy they were.
Was this your first time to Japan, or have you been before?
No, I've been there before. I've been there twice, having photographic exhibitions.
Amazing. Because you've been taking photographs since you were a teenager, haven't you, pretty much?
I think I started taking photographs about the same time as I started modelling. And, of course, made the most of my situation. Whenever I'd go for a photo shoot, I'd ask a photographer to help me use the camera properly.
And was that how you learnt?
That's how I learnt, what to look for, etc. And then, obviously, I went for a photographic course as well.
Because you were photographed by some of the world's greatest photographers, you were taught by some of the world's greatest photographers.
Yes.
No wonder you're so bloody talented. But it's so hard to know where to start with you, because you've had so many, not incarnations, I wouldn't say incarnations, because, you know, from what I know you, and we've got to know each other a little bit recently, but you've always stayed Patty. But you've been through all these extraordinarily varied lifestyles that, you know, partly you had the kind of fashion, the photography, the iconic bands that you were touring with. Is it possible for you to say which one you enjoyed the most, or which one inspired you the most?
What I should really say is that when I was with George Harrison, I never was allowed to tour with the Beatles, because it would have been far too difficult for involving security was major in those days. And, you know, they hadn't really got the whole thing, security, sorted out properly because they were unprepared, basically. And then when Eric and I got together, he asked me to come on tour, and it was such an amazing experience. It was just mind-blowing to be able to be on the side of the stage, very close to Eric in a way and the rest of the band, but then looking out into the audience and seeing these adoring faces and applause and, you know, I mean, it was such a thrilling experience.
So this was Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
Who was your second husband after George Harrison. But with the Beatles, I can imagine it would have been a security risk for you because you'd have all those screaming teenage girls who probably would have wanted to kind of stab you in the eye with jealousy. Was that the kind of main reason? Because they didn't want to be seen as being attached to one person.
Well, there is that. But also, you know, these fans become quite manic and blinded to an extent. All they want is to touch their heroes. So anyone in the way, they just wouldn't notice, you know, and they would rush at them. So it's a security matter for, you know, for the guys as well. I know a lot of fans didn't like me because they wanted to be me.
Of course.
But what can I do? What can I say? Nothing.
Yeah.
I would get lots of letters from fans saying they either love me and they, and George gets millions of letters saying how much they adore him and it's okay seeing me. So they were sort of slightly supportive. And then there was another group who were not supportive at all.
I mean, can you imagine in this day and age? Thank God it was before social media because you would have been trolled constantly.
I think so.
Yeah. So going back, you were the eldest of four children and you spent your early life in Nairobi, Kenya. Do you have many memories from that time?
I do. My Swahili's slightly disappeared, but I absolutely adored it. I loved looking out onto endless plains that went on for miles. And every so often while you were just gazing, you'd suddenly see a little movement and realise that a giraffe is having some lunch, eating a tree, or there'd be little fluffy ears, be a lioness and her cubs, and you know, it was absolutely magical. And this, of course, was in the late 50s, before tourism really started. So the animals were not only wild, but they weren't frightened and they wouldn't really attack anyone, unless they were hungry, of course. So we lived with my grandparents to begin with. And they had the most beautiful gardens that went on and on and on and into the wilderness, which would confuse some wild animals. They'd be in their wilderness and then just walking towards the house, grass getting shorter and shorter, and then they sort of look at us and sort of walk back into areas that they knew. We grew up sort of, you know, taking this for granted.
God, how incredible. But how come your grandparents were out there? Did they have a farm or were they growing coffee? What were they doing?
My grandfather was in the British Army in India and they lived in India. And didn't really want to come back to England because he found it too cold. So they thought they'd live in Kenya. And they bought a really beautiful, sprawling bungalow with magnificent views and gardens. And so when we came out with Mummy and Daddy and my three siblings at the time, we stayed with them for about 6 months, I think. And then my father got a house. He was head of the Nairobi Jockey Club, and then he had a farm and, you know, different things.
It was an amazing time because I've always been fascinated by the Mathega Club, which is this sort of old colonial club there, which I'm sure you are familiar with, and that the whole White Mischief era where Dells Broughton purportedly murdered the Earl of Errol, and it was this sort of almost like the 20s, which had disappeared in this country, but then the behaviour carried on in Nairobi. Were you at the tail end of that? Were you aware of that, or was that kind of ancient history for you?
I was only 9 or 10. I knew that there was this wonderful, amazing, extraordinary story of social bad behavior. And I kept saying to my mother, weren't you there? Why didn't you go to the parties? And she said, no, Tanya, no, far too busy looking after the children. And so she had no stories to give me.
What a shame. But you went to boarding school out there and you had a tough time, most notably because that's when you discovered that your parents had divorced. Is that right?
I went to boarding school there for a year or two. And during that time, my mother met somebody else, must have divorced my father. And next thing I knew, I'd come home, well, come to where she was living. And she said, darling, I'd like you to meet your new father. As I shook his hand, I was full of utter guilt, thinking, what is daddy going to say about this? And then I went back to boarding school and my father picked me up at the end of term. And I thought, oh, maybe that horrible thing has all gone away. But in fact, my mother then, with her new husband, caught the boat with my youngest sister and went to England.
Oh, my God. Can you expand on this a bit? I mean, what do you know how this happened? Did it happen over a very quick period of time?
Well, I was never really privy to what on earth was going on. I never knew what was going on.
And you never found out later? You never found out in retrospect what happened?
I did. I found out that my stepfather wanted to introduce Mummy to his parents and didn't want to shock his parents bringing over four children. So just one child was, to him, seemed not too big a story for them to cope with.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so there were left three of us. And then one sister went back, and then my brother went back, and then I went back. Arriving at Heathrow, I thought it was Disneyland. It was so full of light that, of course, I wasn't used to. And it seemed quite magical.
Were you born in Nairobi?
No, I was born in Somerset. But okay. We went to Nairobi when I was about four.
Okay, so you had, what, how many, 5 years there?
Yeah.
So quite formative years. So your stepfather, you weren't too keen on, I read, and you and your siblings kind of grew very close because of that. Did they remain married, your mother and stepfather?
My mother and stepfather had two boys who are my brothers, whom I adore. Mm. And then he went off with somebody else, leaving Mummy with six children. I mean, what a shit, really.
What a shit. So he left your mum and his two children that he'd had with her?
Yeah, and all of us.
Oh, my God. And then what happened to him? Do you know?
Yes, he married this woman who lived quite near us, and they had a child. She had three children with her husband, left them behind with him. And they were an outrageous couple. I mean, just outrageous. Anyway, she was German. And when I told my mother that this woman had got Alzheimer's, my mother couldn't help but laugh. And anyway, her Alzheimer's got worse and worse, that she could no longer communicate with my stepfather because she couldn't remember English. She could only speak German.
Oh, my goodness. Sod's law, what goes around.
Exactly.
That's unbelievable. So this cad, his behaviour matched that of the inhabitants of Happy Valley.
You're right, but I must say, he was incredibly handsome. He was very good looking, but he wasn't really fun. So I'm sure they wouldn't have included him in their group.
No, and nor should they have done. So, yeah, your mum remarried. And then at this point, you were in your early teens. And did clothes start to feature much in your life at that time? Because you'd grown up in the 50s, which is obviously bleak and grey and conservative, and before the cultural change. So were you interested in clothes at the tail end of the 50s, or did it really, that love of fashion, blossom in the 60s?
I think in the 60s, and I used to go to the King's Road, and there was a wonderful antique market, not the one that's there now. This was another one on the first floor. And there were a couple of girls from Australia who were selling the most beautiful 1940 chiffon-y dresses, and they were heaven. And when I saw them, I thought, this is it. I absolutely adore these dresses. And so I'd buy one or two and cut them a bit if I wanted shorter. Awful thing to do, I know. But anyway, I'd cut them and make them short, and they were just glorious. You see, the thing is, in the early 60s, there was only Mary Quant beavering away for England. But in France, of course, you know, they were really only concerned about couture collections. And they designed for, you know, very rich ladies. And in London, we didn't have anything or anyone who supported us except for Mary Quant, who finally, in the early 60s, her skirt started getting shorter. So everyone would go to Mary. And great designs, I think some of her dresses had kind of geometric designs to them, which were really lovely and interesting. And then Ozzie Clarke started appearing on the scene. We all adored Ozzie. He was mad and eccentric, but he could cut beautifully and do a bias cut, which, as you know, Susanna, suits every figure. Very clever.
Yeah, because a bias cut is great. Unless you've got big hips, it's not so good because it clings to the hips. You were quite curvaceous then, so because you had obviously Twiggy and, you know, Mary Quant, she designed, in my opinion, more for the kind of flat-chested girl.
Yeah.
Did you find that an issue? Were you kind of, because you've got a good pair now, let's be honest. And have they grown over the years or were they quite small in the 60s?
Well, as I wasn't really eating much, they got smaller and I was really pleased. I got down to under size 8, which is actually quite small. So yes, my titch sort of got smaller too. So I wasn't too bad for a Mary Quant dress.
Okay. And it sounds like you were almost creating your own fashion by adapting those wonderful chiffon dresses, which actually the 40s was good for a womanly figure, but you were adapting it by making them shorter as a nod to the 60s. So were a lot of people, a lot of girls at that time doing that, kind of just creating their own designs because there was a lack of choice?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that Ozzie started thinking about that 40s look. And if you look back at some of his collections now, he will have, you know, like a little bit of a wide shoulder and maybe a peplum and all those sort of things that they did in the 20s and 30s.
Mm.
And, of course, using wonderful material too.
So he used a lot of that kind of wool crepe, didn't he, which had a little bit of stretch in it, and then those beautiful covered buttons with the little loops. And, I mean, they've stood the test of time. Do you have any still? Can I come and raid your wardrobe?
No, I don't. I did have a fantastic sort of onesie jumpsuit from Ozzie that was a rusty colour and absolutely beautiful. Mm. And on the inside was silk. So when you turned over the collar, it was shiny silk and very low cut, which was a bit difficult for me. I have to bring out the safety pins, of course. And that was glorious. Otherwise, do you know what I used to do? I used to lend my clothes to girlfriends or friends of friends, trusting they would bring them back. But, you know, they very rarely did. And then I can't remember who I'd lent them to. Whoever borrows remembers. And whoever is the owner,
yeah,
forgets.
So true. Let that be a lesson, listeners.
Same with books. And you can't actually lend a book to somebody, put your name in it as if you're still at school.
Mm. No, yeah, that's so true. Books and money, actually. It's like if you lend money, never expect to get it back.
And music. Lending your music, CDs, whatever, never get them back.
Tents are the worst because my kids go to festivals and then, you know, their friends will say, can we borrow a tent? And I go, well, you are never going to give it back, are you? And they, no, yes, we will. Yes, we will. And sure enough, you know, it never comes back. But at that time in the 60s, who were your influences apart from Mary Quant and Ozzie Clarke? And I assume Bieber came into it as well. Was there anyone who inspired you clothing wise?
I loved what Norma Kamali was doing in New York. And I loved Fole and Tuffin.
Oh, I don't know that.
Oh, they were adorable. The two of them were very, very good designers. They had a little boutique shop off Carnaby Street. And they were very good. And who else?
I mean, was there anyone like, I don't know, I'm trying to think, like Sandy Shore or Dusty Springfield? I mean, the women weren't really at the forefront at that time, so it must have been quite hard to find a role model. Yeah, I mean, you were doing what Jean Shrimpton was doing, and you were busy influencing everyone else.
Well, I don't know. When I first started looking at magazines, which was quite later on, well, when I was 17, and I saw my first Vogue and Harper's and all those magazines, glossies, and Jean Shrimpton was in quite a lot of them. She became my hero. I wanted to be Jean because she was so glorious and looked fantastic, had the best figure, best face, best hair, best everything, and best photographer boyfriend, David Bailey, right? So, you know, she couldn't lose. She was onto a winning streak.
So what was your first modelling job and how did that come about?
Yeah, I think it was with John French. John French was a 50s classical photographer, very tall, frightfully English, and he was photographing a whole bunch of models from the 50s. So they were all very elegant, very aristocratic, and the types that wouldn't dream of going anywhere without their pearls. And, you know, so loads of them, about 30 of them, and then me, the youngest, newest model, wearing something from, who is it? Thea Porter, the most beautiful square-necked silk dress. And I'm sitting in the front with, you know, my hands around my knees, I think. And John lined us all up and then did all the lighting. And then he went back to where the tripod was and his assistant, and he looked through the lens and his assistant was standing here by him. And then he walked up to all of us and like a conductor, he said, 1, 2, 3, now. And the assistant would click the shutter. It's fantastic.
But you must have really stood out because your look represented the kind of new 60s. And like you say, those 50s models were so angular and almost a bit masculine in a way. And yet you are so kind of pretty and feminine and wholesome. It's like you must have stuck out like a sore thumb amongst that lot.
I think so. And I think really that look that I had, Twiggy had, and a few other girls had, was an image of the youthfulness in us. We didn't have the burden that the older models must have had from their parents because the war had just finished when they'd started, you see. And so there was a lot of deprivation, food-wise and clothes-wise, in fact, in every arena. And by the time we came along, I think we all, like a Zeitgeist, realised something was happening, something was going to change. And we were part of the change. So our look was very different from the older models. And we liked different clothes. We didn't want to look like our mothers at all. Mm-hmm. We wanted to rebel. And rebel we did in every area. And of course, if you think about it, Susanna, this is really the start of the arts suddenly bubbling up and coming up to the top. If you think of people like David Hockney and all the designers and the music makers and the filmmakers, photographers, the only area I think where the 60s didn't affect them at all was architecture, which I think was absolutely appalling. If you look at 60s buildings now, nasty, mean little windows. And I can only suppose that the students weren't as progressive as the art students. I don't know.
That is so true when you think of all those sort of council blocks, and you're so right. It was kind of almost brutalist in a way, but without the grandeur that brutalism encapsulated. But also there was, I mean, you know, this is a bit of a cliche for me to say it, but I can't get this image of you with the kind of 50s models and then you, because they, like you say, were very much like their mothers. It was uber sophisticated in the 50s, buttoned up. And then along come you guys with this sort of air of freedom and innocence and wonderment.
I think that the older girls hadn't really any time to have fun and enjoy life. They had to become serious much younger than we did. So for us, it was like an extended childhood. We were bringing our childhood into the fashion world, into the creative world. You know how children can be so creative left on their own, and they just do things. And I think, you know, we were very, the child was very much still in us when in our sort of late teens, early 20s.
Did your parents have any expectation for you? Were they ambitious on your behalf, or were you just like, you know, off you go, Patty, do what you want, you know, go off, have fun and get married? I mean, what was their expectation?
I went to one of those typical sort of girls' boarding schools run by nuns, and, you know, there was not really much expectation from any of us except to marry well. And that was it, as if there was no other choice in life. It was desperate, I thought. And I certainly didn't want to be a secretary, somebody's secretary. The idea of doing the same thing every day would drive me absolutely crackers. And my mother got me a job finally. She said, listen, I've got somebody who's one of the top people at Elizabeth Arden. They said they'd look after you. And that didn't mean anything. It just meant I went to Bond Street, to their main place, and I just sat around looking at magazines. Then I discovered how glorious, glorious modelling must be. And then a woman came in one day and she said to me, Patty, have you ever thought about modelling? And I had to tell a fib. I said, no. And she said, I think you could be great. Come to me in Farringdon Road when you can next week, and I'll get the photographer to photograph you. And that's how it really happened for me. I'm not saying it was easy peasy, because then the hard work had to start by finding photographers to photograph me in order to have a nice portfolio to go take around.
Were there agencies in the 60s, like Models One and...
Yeah, there were probably about four model agencies. Cherry Marshall, who I went to, and there was another woman whose name I can't remember, but her agency was really for deportment, how to get in and out of sports cars, you know, being driven by handsome, rich young men, how you put your bottom in first and then swing the legs over and inside.
Oh, my God. For fuck's sake. Sorry, I can't. That was the agency. And that's what they taught you. So literally, it was like with the book on the head and probably holding a pad and a pen so you could take notes for your managing director.
I remember the name now, Lucy Clayton.
And they were still around. I think they might still be around, Lucy Clayton.
I hope so.
I mean, I remember that because that was an option for me that my parents gave me. You've literally reminded me. And that was, yeah, Lucy Clayton, it was. It was about deportment, but you could learn to type as well, or you could be a model, or you could learn to cook. So it was like a sort of finishing school, but there was this modelling side too.
Yes. So I suppose as modelling became more desirable, she must have dropped all the other elements of her agency.
No, she didn't, trust me.
Oh, really?
But it is remarkable. I mean, I've never really thought about the 60s in any great depth, because for me, I was born in 62, so I was too young. It kind of passed me by. But for you to have done what you did, because there were no female icons. I mean, I had to scrape some together in the 70s. So Germaine Greer and Joan Bakewell and Margaret Thatcher, not because of her politics, but there was a woman running the country. But in the 60s, there was no one. So the fact that you girls did what you did, you really were pioneers, weren't you?
Do you know, when I hadn't really thought about it, but I think you're right. We were. There was no outstanding hero for us.
No, and if there were, yes, there might have been actresses, but they were, you know, a woman could really only be be titillating or a married woman. There was nothing in between. You couldn't be an intellectual. I mean, it's just shocking. So we've got a lot to thank you for.
I tell you who stood out was Julie Christie for us. Yes. We all adore Julie Christie, but only one person, really. That's ridiculous, isn't it?
It really is ridiculous. So, like, you know, we said you were photographed by The Great and the Good and in every important magazine at the time. And obviously it was pre-Me Too. Were you kind of aware of any sort of blatant sexism? Did you ever feel unsafe, or were you more streetwise because there wasn't a Me Too movement?
there wasn't a Me Too movement. I think that guys and men weren't so outrageous in those days. There were the odd ones who wanted to do a little pinch on your bottom when we were modelling. But we, as models, would all warn each other about so-and-so's assistant or a photographer. So we were warned each other. So you knew who'd say piss off to. Mm.
But do you think you were more streetwise than young women are today? Because I think you must have been, because you had to have, you know, we're all so protected and, you know, everyone's got their phones. And I feel so sorry for men. You know, they can't do anything without being kind of called out as a sex pest. But for you, I mean, you must have had a bit of alley cat in you, which I think is a good thing. And that's what I've tried to instill in my daughters.
Well, maybe I do. I mean, you know, some couple of male friends would laugh and say that I was such a tomboy because I had three brothers, and maybe I was a tomboy. So I would like to hang out with the guys, not because they would fancy me. I didn't even think about that. We always became friends. So that was my initial idea, to make friends with people. And with the boys. So it never really went meant further than that, except one boy became my boyfriend. But no, I never really had any issues. Maybe I wasn't sexy enough.
No, now you're fishing for compliments. I'm sorry, Patty. For God's sake.
I don't know. It was, you know, darling, it was a different era. I think men and boys had grown up to have some sort of respect for the girls.
I think they had respect and they were more masculine. And I mean, we're really going off on a tangent now, but I think because men are emasculated to a certain degree now, they become more aggressive because they don't know how else to be and to get noticed.
I know. I really feel sorry for men. I seriously do. Because they're not allowed to be men, proper men any longer, because then they're attacked. And I just think, oh, God, where are the men? Where have all the men gone?
It really is that.
I'm sorry, women have sent them off, sent them away.
So during your modelling, you then found your way onto the set of A Hard Day's Night in 1964. What role were you playing? What were you cast as?
A schoolgirl fan. So I was in school uniform. Now, what's amusing, Susanna, when I was in Japan a couple of days ago, I was signing books for all sorts of people, and suddenly three giggling girls came through and they all dressed like me, like I did on the train, in the film. And they thought it was the funniest thing, and they had blonde wigs on and they were hysterical.
How adorable. That is amazing. And how old were they?
14, 15.
But isn't that incredible that your legacy has carried over to the new generation? Why do you think that is?
I think I probably represent somebody who is fun and I think I represent a sort of freedom and enjoyment of life, which is what they all want. They don't want to be depressed. They don't want to be worried about the world, and which, of course, they are.
No, we are very lucky to have lived, you know, through the times we have.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
But so you met George on the set of A Hard Day's Night.
Which was a funny thing. My agent phoned, I was working at Bailey's, agent phoned and said that I had a casting to go to. So they gave me the address and I went along because I had my portfolio of photographs. And when it was my turn to go in, I recognised one of the people sitting around the table, Dick Lester, who I'd done some TV commercials with. So they looked at me, I didn't say anything, and I went home. And my agent phoned me late afternoon saying that I got a part, I mustn't tell anyone, I got a part in the Beatles film. I said, I think you got that wrong. I haven't even seen me yet. And she said, well, no, that was what the interview was for earlier in the day. But you mustn't tell anyone. And I panicked and I said, well, I never wanted to be an actress. I'd be hopeless. I can't act. And they said, don't worry. You've only got to say one word and dress up as a schoolgirl. And I thought, well, that sounds quite easy. I'm sure I can pull that one off.
And was it with you two, was it love at first sight, do you think? I mean, did he spot you in the crowds or did you spot him? And were you, how much of a fan of the Beatles were you?
I liked their music and, you know, I liked a lot of music, but I didn't zoom in on them.
Okay. And so was it you, so he must have spotted you in amongst the group, or did you just start chatting or...?
No, we were on the train and the train took off to Cornwall and back. And Dick Lesser did all the filming on the train that in those few hours. And I don't remember this, but George apparently asked me to marry him almost straight away. Now, it obviously would seem completely ridiculous to me that it didn't sink in for 1 second, and that's why I don't remember it. However, on the way back, as we were nearing Paddington Station, George said to me, would I come out with him that evening? And I said, I'm so sorry, I can't, I'm seeing my boyfriend. And his face dropped, Susanna, and I thought, oh, God, poor guy, perhaps they haven't met anyone in London yet. You know, I don't know how long they've been here. So I said, come with us. And he said, no, thanks.
I mean, that is, I can imagine you doing that, Patty, because it's like, I mean, but were you not, so, okay, let's wind the movie forward. How old were you at the time?
19.
Okay, so you were 19. So let's take a 19-year-old girl. I'm trying to think who, let's say Harry Styles, for example, is making a video and Harry Styles says, will you marry me? And then the girl doesn't really register. And then going back says, do you want to have dinner tonight? No girl in their right mind would say, actually, I'm seeing my boyfriend. These were the Beatles.
Well, I know. I was very shy and obviously insecure about myself and didn't want to put myself in a, you know, in a situation. I don't know. I think I panicked and didn't want to. It was like, it was too much for me, the idea of going out with George. It was too overwhelming. So conveniently, I've got a boyfriend.
Okay. And you did have a boyfriend or was that another lie?
No, I only lied once.
Okay.
I had a boyfriend. And in fact, he took the cover photograph on my new book.
Did he? So who was that? Because it's such a beautiful profile.
Yeah, his name's Eric Swain. He always thought that he could be Bailey and I should be Shrimpton. You know, second class.
Hardly.
Anyway, so he died a few years ago. But I think that my publishers really liked that photograph.
It's a beautiful, beautiful picture, that. You're in profile and you have this kind of slight beehive. Your hair looks short. I don't know if it was.
It was short, yeah.
You're looking down and the lighting is so exquisite because, of course, there wasn't airbrushing or anything then. It was all done with lighting.
Yeah, and all done with film, not digital.
Mm. So what happened to Eric when and how did George manage to magpie his way in to your heart?
Eric said to me before I started filming, I bet you fall in love with Paul McCartney. Isn't that funny? So then when I told him that, you know, I was going to dump him, and I dumped him not knowing I'd ever see George again.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, so you dumped him. Did you just say, look, I'm not in love with you or not, can we stop going out?
Yes.
Okay.
And then a week later, Cherry Marshall phoned and said that the press office had phoned her and they want to take photographs of the girls that were on the train with the Beatles. So here, I'm going to meet up with George and I can quite honestly say, no, I don't have a boyfriend.
So that did he then say, do you want to go out tonight again?
Yeah.
He was quite persistent, wasn't he? young George.
Yeah. You see, of course, in those days, Susanna, we didn't have mobile phones, so we couldn't contact each other. I think the director, Dick Lester, set the whole thing up.
Ah, he probably did.
He was the little Cupid in this scene.
How adorable. Because we've talked about this, you and I, and you talk about George so being such a wonderful person, and that he was the love of your life.
Yeah.
I mean, do you still feel that?
Yeah, I think about him often. You know, He was such a gentle soul. He was a very gentle soul. But, you know, like anybody and everybody, and particularly creative people, he could just go off the rails and go crazy.
Mm.
And you just have to remember, this is not the real George. It's difficult.
That must have been very hard. But you were the one who got into transcendental meditation. How do I say that?
Transcendental.
Transcendental meditation first. So how did that come about?
Well, when the Beatles went on tour to Australia, I saw a little advertisement in the Sunday Times saying if anyone wants to learn how to meditate, TM, Transcendental Meditation, come to this London address where we have teachers. So I phoned Mary Lees, a girlfriend of mine, said, do you want to go? And off we went, and we learnt how to meditate. So when George and the Beatles came back from Australia, I told George about this form of meditation, and he was kind of interested. And then, I suppose, like about a week later, Paul rang and said, there's this guy called Maharishi coming to give a lecture at the Hilton in London. Let's go and listen to him. So we all went. Maharishi couldn't believe his luck. Can you imagine? Suddenly he was inundated with press.
So do you still meditate today?
Not every day. I'm a bit naughty. But I do like meditating. It does make the day different.
Okay. I've never got it. I tried. I kind of think you have to have patience, but maybe you learn patience through meditating.
I think also if you know in your mind you're just taking only 20 minutes out of your day, which is very short, It's like a minimal percentage, and just know that's what you're going to do before you get up and do whatever you're going to do, maybe after you've cleaned your teeth, you know, just sit down, meditate, and then, oof, you've got the whole day ahead.
Maybe I should persevere a little bit. But so the whole kind of meditation, because that was another kind of fashion opportunity, I guess, because you spent 6 weeks in India with Ravi Shankar. So did you pick up the kind of Indian influence there in terms of dressing and the colour? Because, you know, when I think of you, I always think of you as someone who loves colour. Is that where it came from?
Yes, I think you're probably right. When George and I went to India with Ravi Shankar for the very first time, we stayed in the Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai, and just looking out of our bedroom window, opening the windows, the sun was slightly setting, and everybody comes out to greet the evening in the most beautiful coloured saris, sort of purples and crimsons and chartreuse and greens and, you know, colours of every colour in silk. And a little breeze just picks up a bit of fabric here and there. And they're all congregating, and it's the most beautiful sight for the eyes to try and absorb all of this joyous colour and wonderful people and in front of the gates of India. It was mind-blowing, and that image will always remain with me.
I can imagine. And then, and again, you know, coming out of the 50s, which was sort of drab and houndstooth and, you know, grey flannels, and to then no wonder so many people were so attracted to India, because everything here was sort of John Major Grey, wasn't it, really?
Absolutely. It wasn't going anywhere. It was all a full stop. There were no commas anywhere, you know, and to carry on. No, there's nothing really to look forward to. And I think the thing I looked forward to, besides India, was America, thinking America's really got it. America seems to be really cool. Mm. And I love seeing photographs of those beautiful 50s cars with the winged, you know, the wings at the back of the back wheels. I don't know what I'm talking about. Like old Cadillac.
Yeah, the Cadillac.
Yeah.
But you're so right, because it was. You're so right. Why? Because America was colourful during the 50s, because you had the... You had Knickerbocker Glories, you had all the kind of golf outfits, you had the cars, the Chevrolets and the whatever other cars.
And Marilyn Monroe.
And Marilyn Monroe, and they were colourful, and all the cheerleaders.
Exactly.
And it was the varsity, it was all colour. So how did we become so grey?
It was squashed and grey. Squashed and mean and grey and miserable and nothing to look forward to. And then started breaking out.
Do you think there's been another moment like that that's kind of even touched on the 60s since then, where there's been this kind of metamorphosis?
No, I don't think so. Not in the same way. There has become a metamorphosis which is really, I think, really depressing, whereby people are so worried and upset and anxious, and no one's brave any longer. It's all too frightening. And I think, come on, you know, get on with it. But no, nobody wants to get on with anything. And they don't want to fight. They don't want to argue because, you know, I don't know. It's so completely against me and my thinking and, you know, what I'm all about. I can't imagine being bored. I can't imagine not being excited about, you know, what's in the garden, what's growing, or, you know, if I'm going to see some new friends or meet old friends. You know, there's always something lovely to look forward to. I can't imagine not being lucky enough to look forward to anything, which I feel people are sinking into that sort of modus operandi now. I don't know why. Maybe they think there's no hope. They can't see anything in the future.
Yeah, I think there is that. And I think that people are scared to form their own opinions.
This is awful.
Today.
I know.
If you're not prepared, like you say, to put your head above the parapet and voice an opinion, then there's no communication. And so without communication, what do we have? God, this really is depressing. But it is depressing.
It's depressing, you know, and it's all dishonest. Because people can't be honest because they're not allowed to, because they're so frightened. So without honesty, you have no real communication with someone.
Do you think that's reflected in fashion today?
I don't know about today's fashion. I really don't like it. I think one thing I just can't bear about fashion, which has been there for the last few years, which is so not me, they have the waist right up here, just under the breast. I mean, when is that? When can we slide down again? I hate
what are they doing? Oh my God, Patty! Do you know what? That is so true. That all those fucking prairie dresses that you would have looked fabulous in the 60s, but you know, you got big tits like me. And it's like you see them everywhere. And I actually, this is very indiscreet of me, but I'm going to tell you, because I think Samara Cameron's line is called Seffin. She designs, David Cameron's wife designs clothes. And some, you know, she does great suits and sort of trouser suits and stuff. But I emailed her and I said, can you drop the waist on your dresses?
Did you?
Because we're not, your target audience isn't teenage girls. You know, we are middle-aged women. And we just look like mutton trying to be lambs when we wear a kind of, you know, empire like under the boob. I so agree with you. It's my absolute 101 bugbear.
Really. And it's still every year I look in the shop, in all the shops, still there. I just walk out. I will not wear those stupid dresses.
I so agree. Well, we can't. We just look like we're wearing a nightie
at
our age. It's ridiculous. Or a sort of maternity dress. It's
very unattractive.
Annoying. So I sent Samantha Cameron this email complaining about the height of the waist, and I haven't heard a single word. I think she was probably very insulted.
Oh, really? Yeah. She doesn't know what to say, does she?
She doesn't know what to say. But anyway, I totally get your bugbear. Let's get back on track. So after George, you married Eric Clapton. And with him, you had a real influence on Eric's music, didn't you? Because he wrote, well, at least two songs. What was it? Layla and Wonderful Tonight. You know, probably his two best-known songs.
Yes, I would say so.
Did that resonate, or does something, is that more water off your duck's back?
No, because, I mean, I absolutely adore both those songs for different reasons, but Wonderful Tonight was written while I was there. In a way, we were at home, and Eric's playing his guitar as usual, and I said, listen, we are invited to this party. I can't remember whose. We're invited to a party. We must go. I'm going to go upstairs and get dressed. So I went up and I thought, I don't know what to wear. And I tried on a dress and then some trousers, another dress, hair up, hair down, what to do, jewellery, no. You know, the bed was full of clothes, taken off, thrown down, try on something else. And then finally I went downstairs and ta-da, here I am. And Eric said, listen to this. And he sang Wonderful Tonight. So he, while I was in a tiz about what to wear, he had written this beautiful song.
Oh, my God. What did you feel? Were you kind of like...
Well, I was so relieved he wasn't angry with me, first of all.
For being so late.
For being so late that I could hardly listen. And then when I started listening, I thought, this is so fabulous. This is a wonderful song. I loved it immediately. And do you know what? That was probably in 1975-ish.
Mm-hmm.
This year, 2023, Jimmy Page told me we were going to his party. It was his party. And I'd forgotten.
Really?
Yes.
How amazing. God, you really were living amongst the last of the rock gods.
Yeah.
Weren't you?
Yes.
Okay, so Layla and Wonderful Tonight, two incredible songs, but then George wrote something for you as well.
Yes, he did. This is at the time when the Beatles were all sort of okay-ish together, and they'd been in the studio with George Martin, and they all started shuffling out, and George waited behind, and then he said to George Martin, George, can I just play you something? Because I didn't want to play it in front of the others. And George said, yeah, fine. So he played something. And George said, you have to record it. This is so good. Which gave George Harrison the confidence to the next day when they went into the studio to record it.
So you were travelling all over the place. And did you have anything which you always took with you that you'd consider to be a comfort blanket? Something that, you know, that always came with you?
Because I was sent to boarding school at a young age, I always had my Teddy with me. Now, Teddy knows absolutely everything. He is still alive, by the way, in case you want to know.
What's he called? Name him.
He's just Teddy.
Oh, okay, it's Teddy, yeah. So you've still got Teddy.
I've still got Teddy. And I would tell Teddy all my secrets. He came to all the boarding schools with me, and that's that. And I sort of must have got over it. So now I don't need a security blanket. Since Teddy and I said goodbye, although he's still here in a chair, I don't need him any longer. And I don't need a substitute Teddy either.
Okay, so Teddy is, you know, he's your safety net.
Yes.
When you need it. Okay, I can completely identify with that.
Being at boarding school taught me two things.
Mm-hmm.
Insecurity and independence.
Okay. Look, I'm just telling you, Patty's looking quite pleased with this now. She's looking quite pleased with that comment because, okay, they're two very different things and you would think they'd cancel each other out. So expand, Professor Patty, expand.
So, insecurity. I am still insecure. It's very odd. Even now, if I'm going on a plane on my own, I feel as if I'm being sent away. So I can still feel insecure. And independent, I won't let anybody break me.
Okay, and you think those were the two things that came out of boarding school?
Mm.
Those two, I can completely identify with that. Yeah, because I was so homesick
at
boarding
too.
School. And that I don't have that Sunday night feeling anymore. I used to get it and, you know, until... All my life I've had that feeling,
yes.
That kind of fear of leaving somewhere.
It's rejection, isn't it? As if you're being...
Yeah, rejection and abandonment.
Abandonment. Oh, it's awful. Mm. I think we never get over those completely, those emotions.
No. But they make us independent and they make us strong.
Quite, exactly. So no Teddy on tour.
No Teddy on tour. Have you got any photographs of Teddy? Do you take any pictures of him, by the way? Have you taken his portrait?
No, I haven't. I think our really intimate relationship ended when I left school. And he'd done his job. He'd done his job as a good bear and looked after me.
Oh, my God. So he's never travelled, because you've travelled. Not only did you travel with Eric, but you travelled with your photography because you have exhibited all over the world. And in your photography, what or who has been your most interesting and memorable subject?
I think maybe a photograph I took of a girl called Fiona, who's Scottish. And the story is that I wanted to go and see a friend, Charlie Roth, who lives in Cornwall. And Charlie was, I thought, a great photographer. And I'd had nothing to do one day. And I said, Charlie, can I come down to Cornwall for a few lessons from you? All right, Patty, don't be late, was his answer. So, foot down, all the way down to Cornwall, arrived at his sort of little studio house. And he had his tripod and film and bags and everything, a couple of beautiful models. Come on, you're late. So I trotted along behind him with my camera and bags. And we went to this beach with the most enormous waves. And his models were going to stand in front of the big waves for a thing, something. So his girlfriend, Fiona, said to me, do you want to photograph me? And we were on a beach, a few people eating their sandwiches. I said, yes, I'd love to. So I bending down and I was putting the film into my Hasselblad, winding it on. I looked up. She'd taken all her clothes off. And all the people on the beach, eyes open, stopped eating their sandwiches, couldn't believe their luck. And I thought, better quickly, otherwise this might all disappear. So I said, sweetie, just sit on that rock over there. I can just see it now. And whoosh your hair back in that wonderful kind of pose. And this would be great. So I did that, took lots of photographs. When I went home, in my darkroom, I processed the film. The last shot, Fiona pushed her hair back, and a wave had come in and hit the rock behind her. So it looks as if she is spouting the water. So that was so exciting to see it.
Oh, my goodness. So just the right moment and so much movement, it sounds like, you have in that picture.
Yeah.
Amazing. Now, have you had a major wardrobe malfunction ever?
Ozzy Clark made me a dress. On the last dresses he made, a few of us decided to help Ozzy. He was really on his uppers and lived in this nasty little flat, had a ghastly Brazilian boyfriend who eventually stabbed him to death. Anyway, so I went and Ozzy came.
What? Is that what happened to Ozzy Clark? He was murdered?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So he made this lovely red dress for me and he's obviously working so hard on it. And I was living in a flat overlooking the Thames and Ozzy turned up in the taxi with the big dress and it came out, he came out. We gave him a drink, thanks, Ozzy, and then I put the dress on, got into the taxi, and I think, why are my stockings tearing all the time? Ozzy left several needles in the hem.
So you had snagged tights.
Definitely, yeah.
Oh, my goodness, that's too good. And have you met anyone, Patty, whose style has blown you away?
I don't know. I think style and elegance are quite similar and sort of are in the same boat. But there's somebody called Valentine Cecil. Do you know Valentine?
Oh, yes, I do. Yes.
He always looks very elegant. He's incredibly polite and elegant and always looks stylish, I think. Rock and roll wise, I'm just trying to think who dresses well. I think Elton dresses very well. And of course, the most stylish man, Charlie Watts.
Yes.
He had his shoes made, his suits made, and always looked precisely glorious.
I would absolutely agree with that. Do you have a dress or an outfit which you think of as your birthday suit, like something that really, is fail-safe, I'm going to look and feel great in that?
Yes. It's a red evening dress. It's long and slightly clinging and has lots of beadwork on it. Mm. And it is glorious and it's glamorous and I feel great in it. And red, of course, is passion and energy. And I just love it.
Sounds fabulous. Well, Patty, you have been a joy, as predicted, to speak to, as I knew you would be. And thank you so, so much. And I hope we see each other soon, because I always love hearing your stories and chatting to you. You're an inspiration.
Susanna, it's been such fun talking to you. Really great fun. Thank you for inviting me on your podcast.
Thank you. Oh, my God. I don't know about you, but I felt like we barely scratched the surface of Patty's life, career and incredible stories. If she's up for it, I might have to ask her back for part two. Now, speaking of guys who know their way around a guitar, here's Duo with Manitas. fantastic. You can find Duo's new album Destino at duoguitarmusic.com and follow them at Duo Guitar Music. You can find Patty on Twitter at The Patty Boyd, Insta at Patty Boyd Official, Facebook at Official Patty Boyd, and on her website, pattyboyd.co.uk. Her latest book, which, by the way, is unbelievable, My Life in Pictures, is out now. All the links are in our show notes. Finally, you can find us at My Ward Mal on our socials, on our website at mywardmal.com, and of course, please subscribe, rate and review us on your chosen podcast platform. Ugh, that's a mouthful. That's it. Thank you so much again to Patty, to Duo, and of course to you for listening. Catch up soon. Until then, my wardrobe is officially closed.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.